From the Lynn to Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 16th day of February, 2024. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll hear from this morning's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum from the address that Catherine Tai, USTR, or U.S. Trade Representative, made to the audience gathered there and online, and then we'll take up the weather forecast too with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrient Ag Solutions on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. March corn for the day settled at $4.16.5. It was down a penny and a quarter. The May at $4.29.5, a quarter lower. And new crop December up 2 cents. It settled at $4.58.75. March soybeans a dime higher, $11.72.25 the settlement price. The May at $11.76.25, up 10.25 cents. And new crop November, $11.48.5, 7.75 cents higher. Bean meal futures at $3.45.60, up 6.10. The bean oil at $45.59.41 lower. Soft red winter wheat down 6.5 at $5.60.5. In the March, the hard red March at $5.67.25 down 8.5 cents. Live cattle futures at $187.55, $1.95 higher for 100 pounds. Feeder cattle at $251.25, that's up $3.92.5. And lean hogs at $85.22.5 finish 22.5 higher. Mike Zuzlo, GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us. Two things. One, thanks for joining us on Commodity Week. That's coming up shortly on our home station, many of these stations, as well. And then over the weekend, up online at willag.org. And for making your way on Tuesday, the 5th day of March, to the Beef House. Looking forward to that one.
It's coming quickly, Todd. Let's hope this is the last of the winter weather, winterland that we're dealing with from Kansas all the way over into Indiana at this point.
Yeah, a lot of snow. A lot of snow here. I assume you've got some too. I talked to Eric Snodgrass earlier. We'll hear that, but he says he brought it back from Minnesota. So we'll see how all that goes.
I just thought maybe since the market had been piling on us, we might as well just get piled on with the weather too. Just throw everything on top of us.
Indeed. It does feel like the market this week, well, the last 2 weeks has really piled on. Are we getting close to somewhere where there might be a bottom, or are we fearful that there will be a punch through or a deeper punch through?
I think you're at a point where you probably need to feed the bear with new bearish news. I think that would probably need to come from the outside markets at this stage, because we've taken out, I think, South American weather premium. We've gotten the USDA numbers behind us. The last WASDE report did not give us much in terms of fear about tightening South American supplies. In fact, maybe even the opposite. And so I'll be looking at where China comes back at and how the trade trades when we get back up to full steam after our 3-day weekend. I would say one other thing, Todd, to your specific question is, we are now, I looked at the prices before you and I went on air, to where we're at approximately here this Friday, versus where we closed at the end of last year. And it's remarkable to see that the hard red wheat's down about 12%. Wheat and corn are down about 11%. Soybeans down about 9-10%. We are at a point, I think, where when you get those kind of percentage drops or percentage increases in unison, that's probably the heavy footprint of the funds at this stage of the game. And if that's correct, some of the commodity index charts and some of the other modeling I do would say typically you lose 8-15% or you gain 8-15% when the trade is trading in unison and it's a fund-led market. So I think we are getting close to a point of inflection where you probably need some more negative fundamentals to create another wave down.
Next week, we'll have China back into the marketplace. Carnival, well, probably still running along would be my guess, but I guess we'll get back into the trade pretty heavily at that point. And it sounds like you feel like it could be a week to really watch.
It is, and I think time is of the essence when it comes to China. I don't think I'm the only one that feels that way. I think we know a few things after this week. Number one, I think wheat still leads the grain market as a whole. In terms of putting in a long-term low. So today's price action of soybeans rallying, I did not get behind because the analysis would say you need to get wheat to be, put a low in first. Why? Because of the fund-led pressures that we just discussed. Europe continues to lead the U.S. wheat lower because of, I think, China and deflation pressure as well as Black Sea. And we made a new low in the European market before it closed, which allowed the soft red wheat in March to take out its November low today. So it's the dog and tail. I think the European market is the dog and the U.S. is the tail. If that's the case, the question would be then, why is the trade buying the soy and selling the corn and the new crop like it did? And we really ratcheted that up to almost a 2.52 Nov beans premium to corn, even though Brazilian soybeans are $1.40 cheaper than the United States in Paranagua. So if I continue to see the beans rally without corn and wheat, that will give me a reason, a good reason to get some more hedges in place and start really in earnest on 24 beans.
This three-day weekend worry you?
It doesn't worry me in terms of what more they could throw at us. It could be a really rough week again next week, but I think what I'm leaning towards at this stage, given the stocks-to-use ratios, given the USDA average price in wheat being, you know, roughly 60 cents higher than what you can get for new crop cash wheat right now, it leans me to think that we're probably trying to carve out a late Feb, if not early March, low, kind of like what we did back in 2009, that type of price action where we made a pretty solid low as we got ready to go get into planters.
Hey, thank you much.
You bet, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Yesterday and today, USDA hosted the annual Agricultural Outlook Forum in Washington, D.C. This morning, U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai addressed those that were gathered both online and in person for the event, discussing how trade and agriculture has been working closely together under the Biden administration and some of the wins, along with the goals they believe have been tallied through the last 3 years. Here's an edited excerpt of the trade representatives' comments.
We had some major breakthroughs with, wait for it, India last year. A 70% reduction of the tariff on pecans, removal of retaliatory tariffs on several products, including almonds, apples, chickpeas, lentils, and walnuts. Commitments for additional tariff reductions on frozen turkey, frozen duck, as well as fresh, frozen, dried, and processed blueberries and cranberries. That is 10 commodities that have seen large tariff reductions from India in just over a year. With Japan, last January, a new beef safeguard agreement went into force, which will allow our beef exporters to more reliably meet Japan's growing demand for high-quality U.S. beef. And that's not all. We also pressed Japan to implement a new biofuels policy that will allow U.S. producers to capture up to 100% of Japan's on-road ethanol market. But it's not just about opening new markets. That is important. It's not just about that. We also know that we need to enforce our existing trade agreements so that our people enjoy the full benefits of those agreements. And that is exactly what we have been doing, including under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or what we call the USMCA. I know many of you are following closely the Mexico biotech corn issue. Mexico's policies regarding agricultural biotechnology are threatening to cause serious economic harm to U.S. farmers and Mexican livestock producers. Not only that, we know those policies stifle important innovations that are needed to help producers respond to pressing climate and food security challenges. And this is why last August, the United States established a dispute settlement panel under the USMCA to look at this issue. We will do everything we can to resolve these concerns. Speaking of the USMCA, let's talk about Canada. Canada dairy is a personal issue for many of you. And I want to let you know, as trade representative and as a longtime trade policy, trade negotiator, trade litigator, Canada dairy is personal for me too. If you look back at the history of the NAFTA, one of the first disputes ever filed under the NAFTA was a dispute the U.S. filed against Canada on dairy. When you look at the renewed USMCA, one of the first disputes that we filed under the entire agreement was against Canada, once again, on dairy. Today, we continue to have serious concerns about how Canada is implementing its dairy market access commitments under the USMCA. We will continue to work with Canada to address this issue, but we will also not hesitate to use all available tools as creatively as we have to enforce those trade commitments. And this is because if we really want to see trade benefit more people across our economies, we need to follow the rules that we agreed to. It is fundamentally about fairness and the rule of law. At the same time, we are also seeing agricultural imports grow, and there was a slight trade deficit in U.S. agricultural trade for 2023. But I want to tell you that when you examine the data, what we are seeing is indicators that even this deficit that we've seen for the first time in a long time is a manifestation of the strength of the U.S. economy. The U.S. dollar is extraordinarily strong at the moment, which gives American consumers more buying power on the international market. Also, the products, when we look at the data that are really driving those import numbers, are things like high-value distilled spirits, tropical fruits, coffee, and other products that we do not produce widely here in the United States. Now, I also mentioned that we have seen record levels of farm income. However, and I think Secretary Vilsack is very, very clear on this point, we also know that those gains have not been enjoyed by all American producers. Only about 7.5% of our nation's farms secured 89% of that record income. And this isn't ideal. We can and we must do better. And that is why our administration is working holistically to support our rural communities through trade. We have come so very far. If you think about where we were 3 years ago, if you'll indulge me this, at the top of 2021, we were still deep in the pandemic. We weren't able to come together like this. Our supply chains, including our food supply chains, were significantly disrupted. And we also had significant burden of retaliatory tariffs on our ag economy in place. Fast forward to where we are today. Appreciate how far we have come. But we also must always have our eyes on the future. Where are we trying to go? And we know that there is more that we can do and that we must do. There is so much change that is happening in the world around us, including in the world economy. In closing, I would like all of us to think about how we can use trade as a force for good, as a force for driving positive change, to empower more workers and working communities, to bring about an inclusive prosperity, to promote fair competition so that everyone, especially the smaller players and those in rural areas, thrive and not just survive.
That was an edited excerpt of a portion of the speech that Catherine Tai, U.S. Trade Representative for the United States, gave to the USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum earlier today. You can see more from the Agricultural Outlook Forum easily enough. Just search Agricultural Outlook Forum and USDA, and it should be the first thing that pops up. On this Friday, snowy Friday, in fact, let's check the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass at Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agable. Quite the snowfall here, and you've been traveling through the Midwest. Did you bring it back from Minnesota? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and take credit for that because we, you know, this has been one of those years where we couldn't buy a good event to give us snow. We had plenty of rain. I mean, there's been no issue. We're above historical averages on moisture this winter. No one's complaining about that because we've had a lot of rainfall on unfrozen ground. But it's just the way Illinois is, right? It's this little tiny wave in the flow. It's pathetic, but it targeted I-72 today. And here we go. And if you can get a little hint of like the annoyance in my voice, it's because there's been so many great setups where we just couldn't get into the cold air. And now here we are. Now, Todd, here's the good thing about this snow. the ground underneath this, we didn't have a deep freeze. We're going to get to keep this moisture when this melts next week. So yeah, I love seeing the snow. It was kind of fun to drive the kids to school in it this morning. And for most of us in Central Illinois, just kind of have a quick look out there. You just doubled up on your annual snowfall that quick.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. Speaking of this soaking in, what did February so far and maybe the good part of the winter look like for us and the Midwest?
Well, this is something I missed, right? Because I mentioned way back in November and December, I said, we're going to have a back half loaded winter, right? You remember me saying that to you? I was like, I think it's going to be,
I do.
And we got one instance of cold air that came in from what, the 9th of January to about the 21st of January.
Yeah, it seemed like really long time.
Yeah. Well, what's crazy about that is on either side of that, we've been extremely mild, and it is mild outside by February standards today, even though it's snowing, right? So the funny thing about all this is that this winter is going to go down as one of the record warmest, especially for us, including that cold snap, because it has been so very, very mild for such a long time. Now, when do we expect it to get cold again? Well, we're running out of time. We pick up here in Central Illinois, I don't know, almost, I mean, I bet we pick up 90 minutes of sunshine in the month of March. And we get much higher sun angles, meaning that it's very, very difficult to bring in sustained cold air. And the shot of cold air that's coming in this weekend, it's just that. It's a shot. And it's going to feel like just normal winter, not going to even really feel cold. So go back over mild again. But the big thing, Todd, is this. We've made a significant recovery in drought across the United States. Drought, going back to fall to now, drought air is down 25%. We have got recovery in the soil. We need a lot more. We need to double up. I need another one. And you remember a couple weeks ago, what did I tell you? What I need is a big March 20 blizzard. So we get one more good hit of this before spring rains come. We're going to be in good shape going into 2024's growing season. But yeah, it's going to be mild after this. The snow melts. We get to keep it. Goes right into the soil. All good.
March 20 sounds better than March 5 because that's the all-day-ag outlook. But you know what? We all like to drive our pickup trucks to the all-day-ag outlook and see how things are running. So what's March look like?
Well, if I used El Nino as my kind of benchmark for what March is going to look like. So look at all the historical El Nino events since 1950. It tends to be a bit on the stormy side. And what I mean by that is not thunderstormy side, but storm system. We tend to average about 1.5 every week to 10 days. So that means we'll get maybe 3-4 systems coming in the month of March, each one flowing out of the Southwest, which opens the Gulf of Mexico. And right now, all of the models are suggesting that March is a wetter than average month for us. So I want that. We need March to be a March we don't like so that we enjoy April and May. And so, yeah, I think that's what we got right now. Coldest air will likely be in the Southwest, not over us.
Speaking of April and May, April, May, June, July, got any ideas?
I do have ideas. They're no good, but they're ideas, right? You know, the reality is April is a crapshoot. No one knows what April is. April's the hardest month of the year to forecast. We're just going to live through it, not forecast it. But what we'll be watching in April is how quickly the El Nino fades and what happens to the North Pacific Ocean temperatures. So here it is in a nutshell. If we keep the North Pacific Ocean temperatures warmer than average, I'm talking like in the Gulf of Alaska or off of California's coast, our drought risk stays low for summer. And right now, all the new long-range models which are in, including the newest updates from the Climate Prediction Center, they're all suggesting that we do not struggle with moisture in our section of the country. Looks like we're going to have good thunderstorms and not really be set up too bad. Is there any argument against that? Sure. If we lose El Nino fast and the ocean temperatures of the North Pacific cool off quickly, that starts to ruin our chances of having good summer thunderstorms. But if you ask me today, you know, it's February 16th, what do I think? I think if there's drought risk this summer, I think it's in the Western Plains. I think it's there and not necessarily here. I think the Great Basin is the hottest spot in the country compared to average. Now, we will have hot stretches. We will have flash droughts. But that's why I need the nasty March and the good spring April rains to come through and recharge the soil. So then when it gets hot and dry, the crop still has moisture in reserve. So that's why I want all of us to hate winter, so we love spring and summer.
March does not prefer to be called nasty, by the way. Turn your attention to South America. Yeah. March will be important for them for that second crop or safrinha corn.
Yeah, so to finish February, we've got good rains in the center west, the northern, and the northeast growing areas. It's drier again in Argentina, but not hot. So not a major concern in Argentina just yet. So the new March updates just came out from the European model, and they're trying to drag some of the drier conditions off of the Amazon into the Cerrado. That would be like part of Mato Grosso do Sul, Goiás, these big growing areas. So Safrina's going in just fine, okay? But if we start to slow down the march of moisture, I shouldn't have said March there. We start to slow down the flow of moisture in March, what we get to is the risk of having the monsoon slow down in April. And April is when they're, you know, the Safrina crop's in its reproductive stages and trying to go through grain fill. So there is risk on the Safrina corn side in Brazil, unlike the way that the rains in January undid a lot of the problems from their spring, October, November, December, on those soybeans. So I think if there's a play in South America, it's going to be on the early demise of the monsoon. We'll be watching it carefully and talking about it every week.
Hey, thank you much.
Yeah, you bet.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions, and Agrible joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.